Good evening, Hunter.
Good evening, Jay.
It is too late in the day and too many hours in the sun moving mulch and garden chips around, and I'm exhausted. So for recording number two of the day, this is Jay Leesk and my dear co-host, Hunter Willis, and this is Buzzkill.
Yep, that's right. So Buzzkill, we call it a Buzzkill again because it's a lot of the topics that people don't like to talk about necessarily, like change management and, you know, the higher level things. People get all excited about software and implementation and productivity and all this great stuff, but there's a lot of back end work that has to be done, and those are the kind of things that we're exploring. So when we dive into this, today we're talking about information architecture, information management. And what's actually really funny is that in the fun part of this, and like we were talking about this name Buzzkill, and I feel like the more we do this, the more I feel like we nailed something on the head, because in both of the conversations we had today, like people and almost every conversation we've had with other guests that we brought onto this podcast, they agree. It's like, listen, this is stuff that people, they don't want to deal with it. They don't want to talk about it, right, when we're bringing up these topics. So so talk to me, Jay. For me, information architecture, information management, this topic, super, super important. I feel like it's a baseline where for any kind of collaboration system, information sharing, data storage, all this kind of stuff, the real reason that we're using the cloud, right, for productivity and, you know, making sure that people can access information, the way that it's stored and where it's stored from a virtual standpoint, super, super important, not just because things need to be easy to find, but also because users need to know how and where to access stuff and where things need to be secured or not, right? Like in different locations virtually within different environments, right?
Yes. I'm sorry. I'm totally breaking the fourth wall because I feel like I'm listening to the conversation we just had all over again, but please keep going.
we erased the conversation right before this, and like we both got in each other's heads a little bit and we're trying to get out of it. It's funny.
So why are we doing this, right?
Yeah.
So information management and information architecture are like two overlapping
topics.
Topics, sure, we'll go with that.
Okay.
And in that, so the information architecture is how is that content stored and how do you access it? And the information management is what are the processes around it, like taking it from tacit knowledge, what's in my head, to explicit knowledge, what we as a group know and follow, and even to records, what is an authoritative statement on this topic. And so we wanted to figure out, like, how do we showcase these two different topics, but how they overlap? And so what I'm really excited about today is, as you mentioned, we had two conversations, one with a good friend of both of ours, Aaron Glenn out of Richmond, who works at the Goodwill of Central and Coastal Virginia, which, funny side note, I think it was goodwillofvirginia.com or something like that, but it's Goodwill of Central and Coastal Virginia from an organizational perspective. I thought that was interesting. And then you had a conversation also, and I wasn't able to join. Tell us a little about who you spoke with.
Yeah, I spoke with Matt Barnes. He's an IT admin over at SOAR 365, which is a nonprofit here in Richmond doing all sorts of great work in the community. And he kind of touches on that in the beginning of the conversation too. So it was a really, really great conversation about a little bit of both of what we just talked about, but a lot more on the information management side of things too. So, cool. Yeah.
Well, let's jump into the conversation with Matt first, and then we'll come back to you, my friends.
All right, great. So everybody, hang on to your seats, and here's Matt Barnes and I talking about information management.
I really meant this to be the break.
I'm sorry. So, all right, great. So thanks, Matt, for joining us for this. And so first off, this is Matt Barnes. He's a friend of mine, and we've gone over a lot of the ways that he's set up his environment for the organization he works for, which is SOAR 365. So, Matt, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself first, and then just talk about some of the things that SOAR 365 does, and then we can kind of continue the conversation.
Sounds good. I'm Matt Barnes. I work for SOAR 365. I'm an infrastructure and operations manager. SOAR 365 is an organization that provides life-fulfilling opportunities for people with disabilities. SOAR 365 offers a range of services, from summer camp experiences to pediatric therapy services. We employ many people with disabilities in a wide range of positions that provide services in the community. We have a business development team that's always looking for opportunities to put people with disabilities to work. For many people, a life-fulfilling opportunity may mean doing meaningful work and having colleagues who rely upon you, having a reason to get up each day and work to go do. To others, a life-fulfilling opportunity may mean learning to play a musical instrument or just learning to be self-sufficient. A large component of my role at SOAR 365 is disaster recovery and business continuity. I handle all the infrastructure and a lot of the IT day-to-day operations.
Okay, so that includes like not just the collaboration environment, but also some of the more heavier applications on the back end, databases and things like that, right?
It does. We have been, over the past 5-6 years, we've been moving all of our back-end services to the cloud. We've moved a lot to Azure. The first move, of course, was to Office 365, the mail platform. And then we just continued from there. And now we have virtual machines in Azure. And we're getting ready to finish our move to the cloud fully here in the next handful of months.
So when you were looking at the way that people used to work and collaborate, right? So diving into like the architecture, information architecture conversation, it's kind of like, you know, some organizations go with a strategy where they just kind of let people do things ad hoc. And a lot of organizations will have like a place where like structured content lives. And then they have varying degrees of structure for kind of ad hoc and project-based collaboration, right? But as you know, compared to the way that you all used to work, how, as you've been doing this migration with the file structures and like the way that people collaborate, have you done a lot of like more free collaboration with them and kind of let them do the things that they just whatever they want to, and then have a place for like more controlled and structured file infrastructure? And also, can you talk a little bit about, so like the mentality towards the structure of it, you know, whether it's kind of controlled or loose and like the combination thereof, but then also kind of the way that you are managing like the life cycle of data, right? How long do you let certain things exist and then kind of get rid of them and what that process looks like, right?
Yeah. Well, before moving all of our files to SharePoint, in creating an intranet site, we were using a local file server. We had all of our files saved in certain drive letters. That's how everybody knew how to get to everything. And it was very structured, although it became a spaghetti mess of files over the years.
Yeah.
And when you have many, many, many thousands of files all over the place of all different ages, it becomes difficult for people to find things. That was one of the big challenges. So we decided to move everything into SharePoint, mm-hmm. Create an intranet page to be able to access all of these files. We made the conscious decision to start with pretty much a clean slate. And we did not move over all of our files from all of our departments. We got with all of the department heads and determined what was important to move. And we very much controlled what moved into the new environment. For example, there's no reason to keep a file that's 10 years old that was from a long time ago that serves no purpose currently. Mm-hmm. So we used the opportunity to clean up house a lot. We did decide to go ahead and have a very structured, permission-based locations for files through different document libraries, and only give certain departments access to their files, users in that department. But we're now using Teams to have cross-departmental collaboration with files, and that's been really helpful. We are a HIPAA-regulated agency mm-hmm. since we're in healthcare, so we're taking security very seriously, and we don't have our system open to guests or anything. And we're current—that's a current thing I'm working on. is having essentially another site collection where we can collaborate with guests in the outside world. As far as files go, it is still pretty structured. And as far as teams, we are not allowing all users to create their own teams. We wanted to start this and have IT maintain control over teams so that we didn't have sprawl and have teams created under all kinds of different names and then not be able to know what they're for.
Okay, so that's really cool. So you've got like, you've got some places where people can collaborate and structure. So when it comes to like the really structured kind of lockdown infrastructure, is that, are the collaboration spaces like Teams and SharePoint sites, right, where people are collaborating, those are mostly associated with like their departments, or are they some associated with like their roles as well, or is it mostly just departments?
So where they're, so we have different document libraries that are departmental based.
Okay, so it's mostly departmental based.
And then we have teams that have the file storage for all of these cross-departmental collaborations, all of our committees, all of our different groups of people, different project-based teams,
sure.
Objective-based teams.
For those project and objective-based teams, there's a process that people have to go through to kind of get those. So that's, even though those are allowed, they're more structured as well, or is it more like a free collaboration? Because you said there's like a lot of users, you don't just open it up to everybody, right? You have like a process for that?
We do. The creation of the team and the membership at first is governed through putting in an IT request in order to create that team. And then we assign someone else who owns the team to have ownership of the team. And then we work with that person to make sure that they know everything that they can do within the team.
And then, so from a higher level, are you keeping track of everything that's happening in like Excel spreadsheets kind of a thing? Or is there just, you're just relying on like tagging and name conventions to keep track of the information? And like the other thing I would ask is like, there's like a regular review process for all of this as well too, to understand what's going on, or how
right
are you
now we don't
all
have
that?
Right now we don't have so many teams that we can't just look through them and figure it out. I mean, we don't have 100 teams yet. We just have a very limited number of teams. And once we empower somebody to have the ability to manage their team, they can go and update membership of their team at will. As far as lifetime of the teams, you know, we have closed down a few teams after a project closes. We, for the most part, the teams that were created are still living and used regularly.
Right, right. So that's really good. So the strategy, the overall strategy then is you saw kind of the chaos that was happening with like a more traditional, just kind of a container-based system where people were moving information all over the place. And, you know, there was kind of a loose system of sharing. And then, you know, from that experience, when you're looking at like a new platform, for instance, you took proactive steps to make sure that things were organized and locked down. You got rid of as much of the old data as you could, and then developed processes to make sure that things didn't really get out of control again, right? And it sounds like the environment is manageable enough that kind of locking things down, it sounds also, and this is another question I have, like, it sounds like you have a pool of kind of what we would call power users, right? People that are somewhat experienced with these things, that you can trust to make new content in a way that's within your governance guidelines. Would you feel like that's an accurate statement?
I do. One thing I should have said before as well is we have document libraries for each department, but we also created a shared document library that's available to the entire company. Mm-hmm. And we empowered only a couple of people in each department to add documents to that library. So there's an HR, there's a place where you can go get HR forms and HR information employee handbook, and there's a place where you can go get some finance forms and things like that. There's a place where you can go get IT documentation and training. And all of that's available as a shared location to everybody, but very few people have access to upload additional information. One problem we had in our locally based file system was there were so many shared files that were available to the whole company that it was really difficult to find things. Mm. So we started with a clean slate there and only uploaded what's relevant to today.
Yeah, that's great. That's really cool. So that's good. This is really, really good. This has been a great conversation. I guess the only other thing that I would touch on is that, and this is a little bit off topic, but like we had a great conversation previously about how, just the remote collaboration enabled through cloud platform, like in your case, it's Teams, right, where people can work from home. Your organization wasn't really doing that much, if any at all, before this. And when they had to make the transition from working from home for the COVID crisis, right? I can only imagine that, you know, not only did, in this case, again, Teams was the platform that you guys are using, enable people to keep doing their jobs, kind of save the organization to a certain extent, right? And keep them productive and being able to provide this assistance that they do. But the other side of that as well is that there is this great, you know, you took a more conservative, controlled route of, you know, having a structured place, but still providing a place where people that should be authorized to share things out with lots of people can do that. And then on top of that, still providing a venue for people to be able to, you know, to have this kind of ad hoc collaboration, but with a controlled process around it. So it sounds to me like you kind of looked at the field and were like, look, we need structured stuff. People need to be able to share out stuff, but people still need to be able to collaborate. But that doesn't mean that you should just kind of like let people do what they want, give them guidelines, right? You still got controls over it. And I guess where I'm going with this is that it's really good that you were able to get these kind of systems in place before everybody had to work from home, right? Was any of this done ad hoc and like as a rush, or do you feel like you had it mostly under control before COVID hit?
Well, it was we employed the technologies before the disaster hit. And a big part of my role is disaster recovery and business continuity. And having the ability to, Microsoft Teams really allowed us to, that was big with business continuity. We were able just to keep on working. People started using Teams and we started training people on Teams before this disaster hit. And we had a little bit of adoption problem. We had our power user group who jumped in, and we have a few people who really want to try the newest stuff. But to a large degree, people get stuck in the same ways of doing things, and they don't necessarily have the time or make the time to learn new technologies. Even if it may make their job more efficient. So we started using Teams before all of this, and I'm really glad that we did. When we had to move home, and we've had a mobile first strategy for a few years. We've been replacing computers with laptops. So really, when all of this happened and all of our admin staff started working from home, it was really just getting better user adoption of the tech that we already had.
That's great.
And when people were at home and they had no choice but to try this new tech, they really adopted it very fast. And I'd say we have 100% adoption of Teams now. We have all of our admin staff using Teams every day as the primary means of communication, and having meetings and one-on-one communications. We have been using a lot of it. And that goes to business continuity. Teams allowed us just to continue on working. Business unusual, but yeah. You know, just kept on going. And it's really been a huge help.
So I think the last question I have here, and then we can kind of wrap up, is that I want to know to you, right, how integral to getting everybody to obey and understand, like, hey, these are the structured areas to work. This is where the few people that they're supposed to be able to share stuff to the whole company, right? They understand what they can and can't share or shouldn't put in that area. And then the process for other people to be able to have ad hoc content collaboration, right? How much of this great adoption that you have now is due to like training and change management when it comes to this? Were you able to just like make a, you know, a procedural packet and like send it out and maybe have a few meetings, or do you feel like it's been like a constant thing and the more you train, the better the result is?
I think for us, it's been a constant thing. As soon as everyone was working from home, I was having multiple meetings a day with different departments. We were scheduling meetings with every department and doing training over teams. So really all we needed to do at first was people who had not adopted it yet, just get them in at once so that then we could share screen and we could train them on how to use all the different functions, and everybody picked it up really quick. It is I think a pretty intuitive application. So we didn't really do much in the way of handouts or anything like that. It was all group trainings over mm-hmm. teams on how to use all these new tools.
Mm-hmm. But more than the technology too, also the processes on with that, that the infrastructure that you'd set up, right? Like where everything is supposed to go and like walking them through that process. Did you have to tailor, do you feel like you had to tailor things to the different kinds of users for the scenarios or?
Oh, definitely. It wasn't a one size fits all scenario. We definitely have to tailor things to each department. As far as the file structure, even within departments, you have different groups within departments that need different access to that document library. So we weren't able to be as controlled as we originally planned. We started out very controlled, and then we ended up giving more and more control to the users of where they put things and how they manage their permissions within their document library.
Sure. And how important do you feel like the, and again, not more than just getting them to use the application itself, but like the them understanding the importance of information architecture, do you think that's made a change in the mentality as to how people work and like how they see what they're doing?
I think most people are, a lot of people, we also started using OneDrive at the same time. Mm-hmm. So OneDrive became the place where you put all of your files that you're working on. You know, we have been able to train everybody to not store files on their local machine, mm-hmm. to use their OneDrive, and then use their department files for things that are for the entire department. And then if something needs to be elevated to be shared to the entire company, they go through a couple of specific people in their department to get that elevated to the place that it needs to be for the entire company to be viewable. And by keeping it very limited and having only a couple of people in the department having the ability to upload files that are shared to the whole company, we've been able to keep those shared files relevant time-wise and what the company needs to work. And it's staying clean and structured instead of becoming a mess to find things.
That's fantastic. And that's the goal, right? That's the whole point of having an architecture to all this stuff. So,
well, we need to be able to find information that you need and not have to wade through 100 things that you don't need to find the one thing you do need. And this has been very helpful in that.
That's great. Well, I hope this information will be helpful to the people listening. And Matt, we really appreciate you popping on the call today. Thank you so much for your time and for agreeing to do this with us. And again, I'm Hunter Willis, and we run this with Jay Leeske. He couldn't be on right now, but Matt Barnes, we really appreciate you. And we'll see you around. If you want to say a last word, you can, Matt.
It's been a pleasure.
That's a great last word. Thank you very much. All right. Take care, everybody. Okay, great. So thanks again, Matt Barnes, for joining us on the conversation here about all this stuff. You know, he had some great points about how he structured, the information within Microsoft Teams, as well as, you know, again, he touched on how kind of crazy things were in file systems and how much they recognized the need to clean up things, structure them, and have clear and succinct processes for where what kind of information needs to go in their new environment. And that wasn't just because, you know, he was cautious with Teams and wanted to properly implement it when they moved to the cloud, right? It was also because they've seen what it's like when you don't have proper information management. They saw the chaos. They saw the problems that caused. And he very much was moving forward with a mindset of, okay, how can we do this the right way? right? And so he took a very cautious approach, which a lot of times is very much the right approach, right? To take this stuff. At minimum, you want to do all the planning you possibly can, right? And so it was really, really good to have that conversation with him and explore kind of his thoughts and his process through all of that stuff.
You know, and as you're listening to these conversations and you think back to past episodes, which you may or may not have listened to, if you go back to like the governance episode, that governance is about making sure your workspaces, the SharePoint sites, the teams, the groups, whatever you're using from a technology perspective, the channels in your Slack or whatever, it's making sure those workspaces have a process for deploying them, for cleaning them up over time, for making sure that security is correct in them. Information management is about the data within that. It's how do you get that data there? How do you make sure that data stays relevant? And just listening to what you're talking about, like wanting to clean that data up, because if you don't clean that data up, when you go to search for something, how do you know what you're searching for? How do you know what you want? The relevant information is easily found and not cluttered with a bunch of draft documents that don't mean anything.
And I would say that also in both of these conversations, but you heard Matt just touch on it now, we're also talking about change management and how do you get users to know where things should go? How do you train the users, right? What's the thought process around that? That's something that we've talked about in almost every single episode because it's just as important as any of these concepts or any of the technology or the approaches that we're talking about is making sure the users know what to do and being supporting for them in a way that actually works, right?
Yeah, and when you're talking, exactly, contextuality, when you're talking about how does the user know where to get their information and how to get there, information architecture is a big piece of that. The navigation, so if you're in Office 365, the navigation of Office 365 is tool focused. Am I going to SharePoint? Am I going to OneDrive? Am I going to Teams or whatever? But once you're in that tool, you have to consider how are we organizing this content? From a governance perspective, it's when are we creating workspaces and what types of workspaces? From an information management perspective, it's how do we want to organize those workspaces? You know, if we're doing SharePoint sites and hub sites, what's the top level hub versus the children hubs? And when we're talking about global navigations for intranets, it's, you know, when I'm an end user, how am I thinking about how the content is organized so I know how to go to it? And actually, it's one of my favorite pieces from the conversation with Aaron, which I'll let you get the big details from there. But it's that idea of I'm an IT administrator. I think people should access the content this way. Well, have you sat down and asked your end users, how do you think of this information? When I say the word TPS reports, end user, like, where do you think you should go to get those?
Nice.
And so I think this conversation with Aaron really, there's a lot about the technology, but if you listen between the technical terms of SharePoint and site collections and you hear about how she organized it and the choices she made, it's about the architecture, the information architecture, and it's a really good conversation about interacting with the end users to know what they think a TPS report should be or where they think a TPS report should be. So let's go to the interview with Aaron here. Exactly.
Okay, everyone. Today we've got Aaron Glenn, who is longtime president of the Richmond SharePoint User Group, and she's also what's your formal title at Goodwill of Central in Virginia there, Aaron?
Yeah, so I'm a SharePoint Solutions Architect at Goodwill of Central and Coastal Virginia. Yes, I got to pick my own title and write my own job description.
Yay, that's great. And we're going to be diving into, as we've been talking about, information architecture and structure for what she's doing over there. And now we run the Richmond SharePoint User Group together, and I'm the president. And so we've known each other for quite a while, and we've both also known Jay for quite a while. So really great to have you here. Thank you for doing this. Let's dive right in. So Aaron, talk to us a little bit. So from knowing Aaron, I know that she's got a whole lot of SharePoint lists and a whole lot of SharePoint structure going on to support workflows like trainings and inventory management at Goodwill. She's got it connected to SQL through SSRS and a whole lot of other stuff going on. So for her, when we were talking about this, I was like, perfect example of information architecture. You've got so much data and you're using SharePoint to support so much of it. So talk to us a little bit about how you're keeping track of all these different lists and libraries and also your thought for like how people should collaborate moving forward in this environment, not just for like workflow kind of stuff, but also just document collaboration and how they're doing that.
Yeah. So I'll start with, I've been at Goodwill now for 8 years. I hit my 8-year anniversary in June. And when I came in, we were on 2010 and it needed to be re-architected, which I did when I first came in 2012. That upgraded look and feel, which included some information architecture, has been around for almost 7 years. Oh, wow. And so last year we went through not only a little bit of a re-architecture, but more of a platform upgrade because we went to SharePoint 2019 on-premise, okay? Mm-hmm. And we stay on-premise because we have a lot of data movement with SQL stored procs using in-text workflows and SSRS and a few other things. We do have Office 365, so we are technically a hybrid environment, but we mostly use 365 SharePoint online sites for extranet purposes. And so when I talk about SharePoint, I'm only going to talk about the on-premise structure, okay?
Sure.
And so we, first of all, did not go the hub site route when we went to 2019. Our standard hierarchical structure worked for us. So okay. What I have is one site collection for intranet content. So intranet being published content, most current, includes frequently asked questions, documents, forms, business process automation through SharePoint lists and workflows being really Nintext forms and workflows. And then we have separate site collections for what we call private sites, which people would call team sites. We also have project sites, which obviously are project related. Then we have team sites, which are cross-departmental teams. Okay. Everything except an intranet, so all those other site types, project, teams, and private, are all vanilla SharePoint, meaning no branding, and it's more loose when it comes to permissions. Okay.
Okay.
So on the intranet side of things, we definitely lock down and have a lot more guidance and rigidity to our structure. Mm-hmm. One of the biggest things is, and I've been doing SharePoint now for a long time, 15 plus years, starting with SharePoint Portal Server 2003. One thing working with users and internal customers is they have a full-time job and it's not SharePoint and it's not web design and it's not usability and it's not all the things that make SharePoint work well.
Right.
And so, and I always come out and say, you know, this is my full-time job. So I approach things as I build it and then I hand it over for them to add, edit, and delete from existing lists and libraries. They do not create pages. They do not lay out content. They do not create lists and libraries. So when it comes to intranet content, we have standardizations with documents. So we use managed metadata to tag documents with a doc type, which is a list of about 15-ish document types, things like form, template, user guide, presentation. Things like that. So with search, we can quickly get to all documents that are tagged as a form, as an example. We also have a department metadata column on all document libraries as well. So we basically know who the owner is, right?
Yep.
But when it comes to that site collection for the intranet, there are subsites. So we have laid out our global navigation through the use of card sorting exercises, both the previous version of our intranet in 2012 and our current version that was launched mid-November of last year, of 2019. And I always get a pilot group that will be a cross-departmental group, cross-technical skills, and job titles. So this time, I used a card sorting tool online. It was like $25 because I just needed it, you know, for a quick like month. And I don't remember which one it was, but it was so easy and so great. I had actually reached out to Virgil Carroll many years ago on my first car sorting exercise at HiMonkey, because he's a great usability guy. And he said, determine your top level buckets first. Don't let them determine it. Have them determine what goes in each bucket.
Right.
So learned that. Of course, I didn't listen the first time. Yes, learned the hard way. we always got to learn the hard way, right? So the second go round, I had my buckets, and I had a good probably 50 or 60 people. Mind you, we have about 250 to 300 computing users, which are the ones that would be using the intranet, because not all of our retail folks have access. So, you know, my audience is the 250 to 300-ish size. So again, had my group, they went through it. It was very easy for them to use. And honestly, I had some eye-opening moments. I would not have categorized things the way they did.
Yeah.
I mean, really eye-opening moments. I'm like, oh, well, this goes under our people, and this goes under our people, and this is under resources. And they're like, yeah, no. So I went with what they said, because, you know, that's my audience, right?
Sure.
These are the guys that are using it. So, and with that comes along communication, right? And change management. Yep. So number one, because we did a migration, we had communications around where it was, where it is now, had a graphic of the current hierarchy navigation structure. But also for our new hires that go through technology training, there is an overview of our intranet, and the trainer hits on some high level areas to kind of get people familiar with the content that's available. So that's part of that training and awareness and change management as well. And so when it comes to that information architecture for us, you know, it's really about understanding the audience and making sure that they are trained and aware and can ask the questions they need to ask.
That's great.
Because everybody thinks differently.
Yep.
Yes. Right?
So with that structure, again, I have the subsites for the intranet site collection. And that helps me determine lists and libraries that are associated with the subject. Mm-hmm. So as very typical, or maybe even atypical of an intranet, we have some department labeled sites. You have technology, you have HR, you have marketing. However, most of them are topic driven.
Yeah.
Right? Because you want to call it what it is and call it what the content is. So we have things like training. Well, our training crosses three or four different departments. So just call it one thing, put it all in the same place type of thing. So Hunter mentioned, you know, some of our course registrations. So as an example, we use, again, Nintex forms and workflows. We were a big InfoPath shop before the migration. We started migrating over to Nintex about a year and a half before the migration to 2019, because I honestly ran out of the abilities of InfoPath, plus obviously is being deprecated and no longer supported in the next, what, almost couple years here.
Right.
And I'm a huge Nintex fan, so if I get on my high horse, please stop me, because I am not a programmer. I do not write code. I'm a GUI tool user. So when I say I'm a solutions architect for SharePoint, I build solutions on SharePoint, either with native tools or third-party tools, okay? And Nintex, part of it is because we have a 9-person IT department supporting 1,400 associates, you are limited in the tools and the skills you have. So we do the best we can, right? And it's worked out really well because I have a fantabulous DBA that does all custom databases, writes my stored procs, writes my views for SQL reports and things like that. I do the front end, she does the back end. So what we have done, again, coming back to the learning management system, we call it LMS Lite because it doesn't have a wait list. You know, there are certain functionalities that a typical out-of-the-box LMS system would have. We don't do any kind of SCORM, you know, testing and compliancing and all that stuff. Right. Ours are literally mostly in-person trainings. And we just want to record. We want to record who signed up and then who's attended, not shown, that kind of stuff, right? But we have an entire course catalog. Everything, again, front-end-wise is SharePoint. So if you think about a relational database, we have all these related lists. We have courses. We have a calendar. We have registrations and a couple other little children lists that are around. And every single one of those lists has a Nintex workflow that runs a stored proc to send the data to SQL.
Okay.
So we're constantly either on create or edit running this proc to update the data in SQL. And for us, the source system of data is always SQL. So all reporting comes directly out of the SQL database.
Yeah, nice.
It doesn't come out of SharePoint. SSRS reports are using SQL data.
Right.
Okay.
And from a Nintex architecture standpoint, all error messages come to me because I'm the admin and I built it and I fix it, right? So we do this with a lot of different, what we call applications on top of SharePoint. So we have our learning management system. We have our trailer tracking. So all of our donation trailers, either at the stores or attended donation centers across both Coastal and Central Virginia, are all tracked in SharePoint. That was actually our very first app that we built in SharePoint. We do a bunch of other application. We're building out a salvage tracking system. We used to have some billing for some of our vocational services. I mean, it's for the things that we do without code, I'm very impressed, right?
Let me ask you really quick, how are you keeping track of all of this, right? So you've given us like a really amazing picture of all the stuff you've got going on, and it's a lot, and I'm really glad that you kind of went through it the way you did and explained it and then like showed how it all works together. How do you keep track of it all? What do you do to do that? Do you have like Excel spreadsheets that kind of map it all out, or you got diagrams and stuff, or is it like...
Yes, yes, and yes.
All of the above. Okay.
I mean, really. So, of course, with a migration project, you need a content matrix because you need to know what you're working with, what can be deleted, what needs to be cleaned up, what can be merged. So, you know, periodically, I do that. But part of it is I'm the gatekeeper.
I'm
the SharePoint goddess. So I know these things, right? I know what's being done. Now I'm not at a Capital One. I don't have 10,000 site collections.
Right,
with 10,000 subsites, you know. So my level of manageability is much easier to contain.
So you plan to kind of clean it up on an ongoing basis, as well as you're saying there's enough like control that you've got over the environment to kind of keep track of things in your head as things go on. But you take notes as these cleanup projects come, and that's what you're
100%. Cool. 100%, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, the worst thing is to have an empty site with no content.
Right.
That does not happen in my world.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right? Because I don't let it.
Right.
Yeah.
And you got, and like you said, you've got training, and are you forcing metadata on documents as they're upload? You said you've got your content types, right, for different kinds of documents and stuff.
Yeah, so we have the standard GW document content type, which has the metadata for document type and department.
So we force
that.
Okay.
And anytime there's, so one of like our, you know, we're on this big kick, which is great, about source data, okay, and being able to eventually have a true platform of managed data outside of SharePoint, just organizational data, right?
Sure.
HR data should come from the HRIS. Financial data should come from the finance system, things like that. Well, guess what? There is not one location for a list of all of our locations.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
Yeah. Can you imagine the amount of processes that require the choice of a location?
So that's kind of what I was getting at, right? Is like,
I figured,
you know, and that's perfect, you know, and it's hard. It's hard to keep track of all of this stuff. And I've never seen two people say they do it the same way.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
So kind of coming back around to the trailer tracking, that was our first thing that we did. Literally in month two of my new employment in 2011, 12, whenever I started, I was like, I need a list of locations because everything's going to use this. So my source system for locations is SharePoint.
Okay.
And it's needed not only from a viewable standpoint, read only for everybody, but all my forms use it. I have a business process through SQL that shoots out notifications when that new item hits the database so it can notify other business owners, hey, add it to your source system.
Right.
So, yeah, so it's, you know, I work very closely with our DBA, and she's the owner of data, right? She's technically our principal data architect. And so we know what each other's doing to make sure that we have the foundation properly lined up and we have the right data to be able to use in these different systems.
Mm-hmm. You know, one thing that kind of just going back through what you talked about, there's a few key things that I think are worth really focusing on. One is the fact that you worked with your stakeholders to figure out how do they need to access this information in your system? That card, what'd you call it? Card sorting exercise to figure out how do we navigate the system? How do we organize the sites and site collections? And how do we really, how do you access the information? Not how do I think you need to access it, but how do you actually need to access it? And the fact that you followed that up with change management on top of it. So not only did you make something that was intuitive to the users based on their feedback, but then you followed that up with a process of making sure they understood what the changes were across the broader membership. I think those are key. And the other piece that I hear you talking about a lot is your active planning. So Hunter, you caught on this one. The fact that you go back and review a lot, Aaron, the fact that when you're reviewing, you're documenting, that active participation and active planning as you go, it's not plan everything up front, do everything, move on, but it's also not do stuff and I hope I remember what it was, right? Like that middle ground.
Exactly. And I'll tell you from personal experience, I'm not a fan of having everything considered an intranet and then locking down document libraries for collaboration department level stuff. Right. I have found it's so much easier and cleaner for the end user to understand anything on my private sites. I can't send links to unless they're part of my department, right?
Okay.
No sharing stuff allowed here, right? And it's working documents, so I'll turn on versioning.
Mm-hmm.
And they're allowed to do folders over there because, again, I need it easy. We all know metadata is not always easy. And when it comes to a working document and it's the audience scope is so narrow to that department, they can figure out their structure they want.
Yep.
I don't have to hit them on the head with a hammer and say, fit into this hole that I've made. Right. And it, of course, there's always things like long file names and long folder names. I try to educate, but it's not the end of the world. There's things I have to allow to give up.
Makes a lot of sense.
Well, also, Aaron, I really like, so you're talking about the different types of workspaces too, and how in this type of workspace we have no sharing, but we have file folders, and the end user designs their working area. And in this type, we have these other restrictions. That's when I talk about information architecture with customers. That initial, what types of workspaces do you need, and what does each type require to be successful? Like that's step one. Before we actually design what we're going to call it, and before we design what SLAs we're going to give to our customers, understanding that base piece is huge. So that's awesome. Thank you.
Yeah. How do you work, right?
Yeah.
Across the board.
And as we all know, people like to keep things tight, confidential, lock it down. And then there's the flip side. Open it up to everybody.
Yeah.
You
know. Well, yeah. Well, thank you so much for being on today. This was a ton of great information. Aaron is exactly what we were looking for.
Yay.
You know, really in-depth example of, you know, information architecture in a diverse environment here. You know, you've got this hybrid Office 365 SharePoint going on, but there's also heavy use of SQL and a lot of other systems that are going in and out of there. So thank you so much again for walking us through all of this and kind of giving your insights and your history on how it kind of came to be that way. Really, really great example of, again, information architecture in a practical working environment. So really appreciate it. Is there anything that you'd like to close out with? And
I appreciate you guys having me on here. Hunter knows that I can talk about this for hours because I'm a little bit excited and passionate about it.
Some of the best content, man. It's fantastic. It's so specific, and I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But thank you, guys, Aaron, for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for coming on.
Of course.
All right, great. So, yeah, thanks, Aaron. Really appreciate her coming on here. Good friend of mine. Worked fairly closely with her over the past
couple
years.
She's my friend, too.
Richmond SharePoint user group. That's right. She's known Jay for quite a while, too. Good buddy. Good friend of both of ours. So, anyways, really, really good information that she brought to the table. I love Aaron's presentations because they are so – she knows she's got it all right here, and you can tell, and she loves it. It's like – here's how I did. Here's what we did. Here's the problems that we occur like. And, you know, she, yeah, go ahead.
It's a clear sign of planning, right? Like there's a reason she's excited is because it's meeting a mission. And there's a reason she's good at telling the story because she spent so much time understanding what should that story be. And if there's one thing that goes through all of these Buzzkill podcasts so far, it's you have to plan. You have to stop and think, okay, how am I going to organize my workspaces? How am I going to tell the end users about the changes? What technology should we use and why? How should we navigate to those spaces? It all ties to that same concept, which is it's a foreign concept in IT. We plan for how much time am I going to need to do the server install, and how much time am I going to need to update the software, and how much time should a PM have to manage the project and a QA person to test it. But we don't really have the ability, and this isn't a lack of skill on us. This is a lack of funding and resources. Yeah. That we don't have time to do this planning. And that's why it's a buzzkill, because it's so important. And it helps us get so much further, but it's always the last thing on everybody's list.
I was, Amanda brought this up as well in the last episode that we did. And Matt and Aaron both brought this up. I was speaking with a friend of mine, too, that works with the organization here with the under the state of Virginia. And as a side conversation outside of this podcast, but she said the same thing. It's that these are conversations that and things that... you know, higher ups and organizations need to hear and understand, yeah. And it needs to be broken down with them. And then the idea that all of this planning and everything, a lot of times they don't understand why the planning's necessary. They want you to just turn it on and roll it out, and that's their requirement. But, you know, the conversations that we've had and brought on as examples on this podcast, everybody is saying, listen, this is stuff that needs to be meticulously thought out beforehand, and once it's implemented, there needs to be revision and process improvement that is fueling how you're going to push the change management that goes along with this implementation over time. It's never a one-and-done project, and that's especially true with the topics that we're talking about, right? Governance, change management, information architecture. It's this fluid thing that keeps moving over time. Now you can roll other, you know, other concepts. You can roll other platforms and other applications into these kind of ongoing, you know, processes that you have, but they have to tie in, and it has to be done, like Jay said, in and Aaron and Matt both touched on this too, from what the end user needs, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So we were going to talk about this in this episode, but we didn't really get into it in the interviews. I'll just touch on it very briefly. So if you're trying to figure out, like, how do I create an information management plan for everything? And how do I create information architecture for everything? Like, look, we talked about this with governance. You're not going to. If you try to plan for everything, you're not going to get anywhere. But what you want to do is you want to do something like look at the risk value framework for records management. You want to identify as much as you can, like the 80-20 rule, like 80% of, I just said like three times, sorry. You want to look at, you know, how can I find 80% of my subject matter and bundle that into as little effort as possible so I can spend more time on the 20% that's really hard. So when we have records conversations, we're trying to help people set the records tags and the rules around records for that 80% mark, so that the records manager, who is a very small amount of resources as compared to a total organization side, can focus on those nitty-gritty pieces. Well, in information architecture, in information management, in governance planning, like get that big bunch out first, and then over time you can start adding more in. And I think that's the part that most people miss, is they sit down and they look at the breadth of information and they're like, we can't figure this out. This is too much. Let's just move forward and we'll see what happens. But if instead, you know, you put it all up on a board, and let's say you take post-it notes and you put all your topics in post-it notes and you put them all up on a board, and you can gather 50, 60% into one bucket. Now you have a subject to start from. And then you can make the buckets for the rest as you figure it out. And I'm using very high level terms. So what's a bucket refer to, and conceptually, it's that concept of just trying to figure out like how to attack it as efficiently as possible without trying to boil the ocean, without trying to get everything.
For sure. Well, these are great. Yeah,
I feel like in your responses, for sure, I've gone too far. I apologize.
No, it's good though. It's, you know, and I feel like you are doing this summary and kind of bringing it all in together here a little bit and adding on to the end with the tagging and everything. These other concepts of records management, there's a lot of different solutions depending on the kind of data, right? Because it's not always just files and folders and whatever platform that you've got. Sometimes it's data and databases. Sometimes it's like the whole server itself is a thing, and sometimes it's people managing networks that are connected and transferring data and things like this. So it's like there's a lot of, and we recognize this, right? And we try to stay true to that in this too. But it's to say that, you know, all of these concepts are important, and what it all boils down to again is just making sure that things are structured, you're preparing well, so that when you can implement governance, you know how it can be done. You know, you have a starting point for it, and you can implement a strategy because your information is actually structured in some way, shape, or form. And then, of course, making sure that there are processes that the end users know how to understand what they should be doing to interact with the data, input, output, search for things, et cetera, et cetera. So this was great, though. This was a fun conversation tonight with Jay. And I feel like the conversations that we've had with Matt and Aaron this week, I think they went really, really well. So I definitely appreciate both of them popping on, and appreciate you listening to the podcast here. I think this one was a lot of fun, man. So
So we're a half dozen episodes in. I've had a lot of fun having these conversations with you and with our guests. What I'd love to, you know, we've got two more topics lined up, a conversation about shadow IT, which is a more technical conversation from... well, it's not really. That's the funny part, right? You think about it as. But so we have Shadow IT coming up, and we have another one on risk.
We'll explain what he means.
We have another one on risk coming up, and both of these, I think, fit into this whole planning and efficiency and end-user engagement type stuff. If you have a topic that you wish we covered, let us know, and we'd be more than happy to line it up for a future episode. If you have a guest that you think would be really good to talk about one of these topics, or bring a topic, like, I'd love to talk to them. Clearly we enjoy the interview. Hopefully you also enjoy the interviews. That's it for me. I got nothing else.
All right. Great. Me neither. So let's turn it off. All right. Thank you, everybody. Take care. See you next time.
Bye-bye.